This time on Weather Brains, looking at the aftermath of severe weather.
Lo and behold, we got down into the area, and it was a narrow track. You could actually see evidence of the circulation.
We learn about storm surveys, why the National Weather Service conducts them, and what we learn from them. Also, the storm survey Brian Peters will never forget.
1/10 of a mile of a county road, the asphalt was ripped off.
We'll tell you where and when it happened. J.B. Elliott takes us on the road to the site of the lowest temperature ever recorded on the North American continent.
-81.4.
Know where it is? Stick around. Plus, do you ever get frustrated with the way television stations promote their weather radar systems?
Our Doppler weather radar is the most powerful within 10,000 miles.
And the truth is that they don't even own one that works.
More on that, and when people do interesting things with weather names.
I can't believe that 850 couples named their child Katrina last year.
Plus, this week in weather history, that and quite a bit more next. It's episode 68 of Weather Brains, the program that's all about weather, produced by the Weather Company. I'm David Black, welcoming you and thanking you for joining us. With us for this ride, James Spann, J.B. Elliott, and Brian Peters, and Kevin Selly. A motley crew. James, how goes it?
Hey, I'm excited. Summertime is almost here.
Summertime. Nice,
yeah.
Nice and warm for folks. Of course, some parts of the country still, I guess, a little bit in the chill, so to speak.
Now, you do a baseball, James?
Yeah.
Almost. This is tournament time. We have a 9-year-old who plays baseball, so we're down to the one-and-done tournament. So we've got a game Thursday, and we'll see if we can keep playing.
And keep winning?
Keep winning.
Yep. All right. Kevin Sully, what you doing, man? How's life in the Lone Star State?
I'm very well, David, but I'm going to go right out of the gate here and take a moment to register a complaint against the guy who does the weekend weather, because Mike Umscheid last week, who was the radar meteorologist during the Greensburg EF5 tornado, in that segment was called Tim. So whoever does that segment needs to be shown and labeled as a numbskull and reprimanded, and I apologize for doing that to Mike.
We need to get a message to that guy. He's just not cutting the mustard.
Anyway, thanks for letting me do that. I am well and happy to be here.
Very, very good. And Mr. Elliott, how are you?
Real good, unusually good. Had a great evening meal that Judy cooked. Mm. One of the best meals I've ever had in my life.
So you ate well. What'd you have? Can you give us a clue?
Beef roast and potatoes and Brussels sprouts.
Wow. Sounds like some of the culinary endeavors that Brian Peters has sometimes, too. Isn't that right, Brian? You eat like a king.
Never.
Never? Hamburgers and fries for you?
No. Turkey meatloaf.
Oh. Is that healthy?
It's healthy.
Low calories, and does it taste okay?
I don't know about calories. Tastes great.
Tastes great.
It's healthy.
Tastes great, less filling.
Less filling, yeah.
I love meatloaf.
All right.
Low fat. You know how that goes.
Oh, boy. So we don't.
I mean, well, because I got rain in the middle of drought.
You got rain in the middle of a drought.
Yes.
Congratulations. That's wonderful.
Yes. Last Friday evening, it was wonderful.
You got about a half an inch, didn't you, Brian?
2/3, actually. It was wonderful.
Okay.
And lots of folks in the other parts of the country are really wishing for rain, not to mention folks in the southeast. So maybe the patterns, I don't know. What are the prospects of a big rainfall for any great parts of the country at this point, guys? Anybody know?
Nil.
Ooh. Just.
I think we're going to look to tropical season. I think a lot of droughts are going to be broken by tropical season this year. That's my long-range prediction.
I'm right there in his same camp.
Okay. So we just have to wait and deal with it. Well, cold weather is not what we're experiencing in a large part of the country, but we've had some cold the past few months, and we're finding that it is not all that friendly to the clothing business. And the man who died a hero in Greensburg, Kansas, those are two of the items from Kevin Selly with The Week in Weather.
The Week in Weather from WeatherParty.com. Robert Tim Buckman, a 46-year-old police officer who became the 10th victim of the May 4th EF5 tornado in Greensburg, Kansas, was able to be in attendance for the wedding of his daughter. Unconscious and a few hours before being removed from life support last Tuesday, Buckman symbolically gave away the bride at a ceremony at his bedside. Family members said he died being a hero. He was sworn to protect people, and that's what he was doing the night he got picked up by the tornado. The National Weather Service of France has launched a new service designed to help companies anticipate abrupt changes in the weather. A program called MetNext will provide customized indices to businesses about upcoming weather risks. Industries as obvious as farming and energy producers will use the service, but the garment industry and makers of soft drinks and ice cream are affected by the weather. It is estimated that in industrialized countries, as much as 20 to 30% of gross domestic product is directly influenced by the weather. Back in the United States, women's apparel sales fell 6.5% in April to their worst level in a year. A cold month across the country and a major eastern storm are being given the blame. Climate data shows April 2007 was the coldest since 1997, while April 2006 was the warmest on record, according to weather tracking firm Planalytics. And you won't be seeing as many Katrinas at the local playground. According to the Social Security Administration, only about 850 baby girls were named Katrina last year. The name had gradually been falling in popularity from a peak in the 1980s when it regularly ranked in the top 100 most popular names. Down now, all the way to the rank of 382nd behind Brenna. Ironically, in Louisiana, there were actually more babies given the name of the monster hurricane in the 12 months after the storm than the previous year before. That's the Week in Weather. For more weather news and information, visit weatherparty.com.
Thank you very much, Kevin Sully. You know, that guy who does that show, The Week in Weather, he might make a mistake every now and then, but I think overall he's pretty good.
I can't believe that 850 couples named their child Katrina last year. Isn't that an amazing number? I just can't get over that.
A lot of babies being born.
I guess, but Katrina, come on, folks.
That is kind of unusual. I'm not going to criticize it, but I have to say it does seem a bit unusual.
I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe
got
people,
me.
People, maybe they had a connection to that name before the hurricane. Is that possible?
Well, that's a good point. Yeah, it apparently was very popular back in the 80s, so, man, what do I know, right?
Yeah, all right. We're not criticizing Katrina, but we just are curious about it.
Yes. I wonder if this year's sea storm is going to be Big Chantal. Maybe that'll be the new name for the next 2 years.
There you go.
Chantal.
That's a French name, isn't it?
That's a pretty name.
The next year's sea name is Cristobal.
I like how you say that, James. It's got a certain ring to it.
That does have an interesting ring when he says it that way, doesn't he?
Say that again, James.
Cristobal.
Can you say fine Corinthian leather like that, too?
No.
Oh, okay.
Will you be saying it that way on television, though?
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on.
We're getting into a rat hole here.
We're in big trouble.
Yeah.
Want to talk about something that Kevin did mention real briefly in The Week in Weather, and we of course, talked about the tragedy in Greensburg, Kansas. And anytime there is a major severe weather outbreak, it doesn't even have to be really a major outbreak, the National Weather Service goes out and performs a very important function. And it's one I know, Brian, you were involved in as well when you were a warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Alabama, and that is conducting the storm survey. Now, Kevin Sully, you have some experience in this too, and we really want to learn about what they're all about, what they accomplish and why they're conducted.
Well, David, Gary Woodall is the WCM, or Warning Coordination Meteorologist, at the National Weather Service office in Fort Worth, Texas. And to find out about storm surveys, I went to him and the research and the analysis that goes on after a storm rolls through an area. So I started by asking Gary what kinds of things might trigger a survey.
No, Kevin, because of time and staffing limitations, there'd really be no way we could go out and survey every storm. But basically, the two main criteria we look at, was it a significant event of some sort of substantial damage, some sort of human casualties that might have been involved, extensive media attention? Was it significant in some way, noteworthy in some way, to really need to document it in more detail? Then, of course, the other criterion is, do we have the time and the staffing resources here at the office to be able to go out and do the survey? While the surveys are obviously very important in documenting these events, if we have ongoing severe weather, then the actual warnings and statements for the here and now have to take precedence over that.
What about reporting from the public? Say I have just a few branches down in my backyard. I shouldn't call you then, or do you like to just know about that stuff and you might not survey it?
It's important for us to know about all reports, and we certainly will take reports from any source. Now, if we start getting tornado reports and significant winds, things of that sort, obviously reports that come from trained storm spotters and people that have experience observing and reporting these type events will probably give them a little bit more weight. And if we get, for example, strictly a public report, we might try to contact some of the trained storm spotters in the area to try to get some confirmation. But we certainly do and will take reports from any source that's out there via any means, either the telephone, or we actually have a section set up on our website where people can send us storm reports over the Internet as well.
That's kind of neat. Now, what about you specifically? Do you go through, I know you've done a lot of these, but do you go through some specific training to start doing these reports or surveys?
Yeah, all of the warning coordination meteorologists in each Weather Service forecast office has a warning coordination meteorologist, or okay. WCM for short.
Right.
They have to go through a training course, a two-week training course, and one of the modules in that training course is on doing damage surveys, the methodology that's involved, and some of the evidence to look for when out in the field. So we all do get some baseline training, but some of the best training I've actually gotten is going out and doing it myself and sort of sharing and comparing my findings with some of the wind damage and damage survey experts across the country.
Well, I'm interested in the module then. Can you give us a little bit more flavor of what that's like? What's in that course?
Well, basically, we talk about how to determine tornado damage versus downburst damage, a probable tornado versus a probable downburst damage. Some of the clues that we look for there that would include the width of the path versus the length of the path. Do you see evidence of convergence, damage kind of blown in towards the center of the track, which might suggest a tornado? Damage kind of laid out straight or fanning out might suggest a downburst, for example. We talked some about the methodology that's involved, making the contact, making sure that you have access into the damage area. We even get down into details such as making sure you have protective clothing and your identification with you to be able to perhaps get into damage areas that you might need to. We talked some about the surveying itself, both from the ground, where, of course, you can really get in and look at the details, and from the air, which, of course, helps out with looking at the bigger picture of what might have gone on in an area.
Well, after a storm, one of the first things that most people want to know, was it a tornado? Can you go into a little bit more depth between straight-line damage and tornadic damage? And you talked about convergence versus things spreading out, but tell us a little bit more about what you look for with that.
Sure. Well, that is oftentimes one of the most controversial decisions that we have to make. Basically, what we look at, some of the evidence that we try to look for, if the track is long, narrow, well-defined, sharp, pretty sharp edges where it begins and where it ends on the sides of the track, that would suggest probably a tornado. If the track is sort of broad and diffuse, then that would suggest perhaps a downburst had taken place.
Once you have some notes and then maybe some photographs, do you then go back to the office and compare that to the radar data?
Yes, we will look at radar data as well. And now radar, of course, will not show us everything. We can certainly have small tornadoes that the radar does not detect and resolve very well. But we will try to compare that with radar data and try to determine what went on. And again, even radar data, if we have a good signature, that's even is not necessarily 100% guarantee. This past spring, in late April, we had a storm that moved up through McLennan County, and it was what's called a bow echo. A portion of the storm had sort of bowed out and accelerated out ahead of the rest of the radar echo,
mm-hmm.
and that's usually a signature for a downburst, for mm-hmm. a damaging straight-line type wind event. Well, we got damage reports from out of McLennan County, the east side of Waco, and they said they thought it was a tornado. And we were looking at radar and certainly not expecting to see that, but But lo and behold, we got down into the area, and it was a narrow track. You could actually see not just the convergence that we mentioned, but you could actually see evidence of the circulation flow back upstream on the left-hand side of the track, downstream on the right-hand side. So even in that case, we had a small tornado, it looked like, out of what overwhelmingly would have suggested a downburst just looking at radar. But yeah, we basically look at all the information, all the eyewitness accounts, all the data we can get a hold of to try to document the event as well as possible.
Well, you touched on something that I've always wondered about. It seems that every time there is storm damage, especially to people that were affected, but the people around it, they automatically want to assume, but with such vigor, that it was a tornado as opposed to straight line winds. I can't tell you the number of times I've said to people, well, no, it was actually a straight line wind event as opposed to tornadic, and that's just not good enough. It has to be a tornado. Do you know why that is? Is it just more sexy to say it was a tornado?
Well, I think there may be some psychological aspect to it, a little bit more, significant sounding, maybe, to say that it was a tornado versus a downburst. But downbursts certainly should not be minimized. We've seen tremendous downburst events here in North Texas that certainly cause the same damage that a medium-sized tornado would cause. So basically, wind is wind, and it's going to do damage when it gets up to those type of speeds, and it really doesn't matter if it's blowing straight or if it's blowing around in a circle. It's certainly going to do damage.
Well, now, you bring up a good point when you say it really doesn't matter which one at the event, but then from a research standpoint, it becomes very, very important, right?
Exactly, yes. As far as the impacts are concerned, wind is wind, and it's going to do the damage. But as far as the research, as far as looking for radar structures, as far as the climatological record, it's important to differentiate what type of event we have.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about when there are fatalities involved? Does that change the process for you guys at all?
Well, usually if we have fatalities or a number of injuries, that will almost guarantee going out and doing a damage survey, even if it wasn't all that significant of an event, maybe a small tornado or very localized event. If there are fatalities that are involved, then that will make it a much higher priority for us to try to get out and do the survey. Then if we have numerous fatalities or many, many injuries, that might actually trigger a higher level investigation, which is called a service assessment, which is a national-based activity where we have several people come in from outside the area and take a very close look at the office's operation, the performance of the warning system, the response of people that were impacted by the storm. And that is a much higher level and a much more formal process than the local surveys that we spend the bulk of our time doing.
Well, I know at your office, after you have a damage survey, you usually post something on the website. Is that pretty common around the rest of the country? Anybody that gets a storm event in their area, should they look to their local website, National Weather Service website, for some sort of information?
Yes, it is. Most every forecast office will put some sort of information up, either the statements, the findings, perhaps a map of the damage, maybe some damage photos as well from the area, again, helping document the information. That's a pretty common practice, especially for those offices that get a lot of severe weather, hazardous weather, and unfortunately, you might say, get a lot of practice doing these type activities.
Well, Gary, you've been doing this a long time. What is the coolest thing that you have seen, would you say?
Probably the coolest thing that I've seen was, actually, I was doing an aerial survey of the Veterans Day tornadoes a few years ago in eastern Tennessee. And one of the tornadoes, fairly large, probably a quarter of a mile wide or so, actually moved through a fairly heavily wooded area. Not extremely heavily, but fairly heavily. You could look down and see almost a perfect spiraling pattern to the trees as they were blown down. One of the clearest indications I've ever seen that yes, this was a tornado, and it definitely was not a downburst. It was really, really an interesting thing to see from the air.
What about the thing that was toughest for you to see?
Well, in a lot of the surveys that I've done, I'd have to say this is the case, and that's seeing the personal loss that takes place. have to try to harden yourself as much as you can, because you're out there to do a job, you're out there to document what's going on. But as you're sifting around and looking through the rubble, realizing that that's people's lives and livelihood and everything that they've worked for scattered out in the field, that's a little bit difficult sometimes. On the flip side of that, though, we have had people come up and say to us, we knew the storm was coming, we heard your warnings, we were watching TV or listening to the radio, we heard your warnings, we took action, we took shelter, and we were able to save ourselves as a result. So even in the toughest times, there can still be some gratifying moments like that as well.
So that's Gary Woodall. He is the WCM, the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in Fort Worth, and I appreciate his time. You know, I've gone to storm sites afterwards, and I imagine it's got to be very hard to go and work, because when I go, I just sort of look and survey for my own, but there's always this sort of empty feeling. But I know Brian Peters is on a special team of people who can go and evaluate and survey F5 or EF5 tornadoes, right, Brian?
Yes, it's called the QRT, or Quick Response Team.
I've got kind of a strange question for you. First of all, how many people are on that team?
The last time I checked, I believe there were 20.
20 people. Now, this may sound like a strange question, but I mean it sincerely. Of those 20 people, in some way, for you personally, and you think the rest of them, were really kind of almost really wanting or itching to go to Greensburg?
Well, after I saw the pictures, I know I was certainly ready to go if they called me. There's something about seeing the storms that are so big like that. Like Gary Woodall was talking about, and Gary and I are good friends, you kind of harden yourself because of what you have to do. You have a job to do out there. It's different. You know, it's trying to document the storms. But You have to sort of harden yourself, because you do see people's lives just turned over with these storms. But, of course, when you have the big ones, I remember the day that I got a call to come and be part of the survey team. In this case, it was a regional disaster survey team for the Gerald, Texas tornado. I'd only heard just little bits and pieces about it, but I was very excited about going because of the magnitude of that particular event and to be able to witness it firsthand.
That was an F5, is that right?
Yes. If there's ever been an F6, I think that could have been it.
You said something, if I recall, about that tornado, Brian. Did you not say that that actually peeled up pavement?
Yes, it did. There were three different locations where that tornado, which a lot of people don't realize this, but that tornado was moving from northeast to southwest.
Yeah.
At a very slow speed, on the order of 6 or 7 miles an hour.
May 1997.
Yes, and when you think about that for a moment and think about that slow speed, the tornado force winds, what are tornado force winds? I mean, they're anything from 60 to 300 miles an hour, but those high winds, and this was an F5, those high winds were over one spot for 7, 8, 9 minutes.
Wow.
Even thinking, I mean, just bring it down from 300, bring it down to 150, it's still, I just can't fathom 150 mile an hour winds for 7 minutes. And there were three different locations. I was responsible for handling the aerial survey, and there were three different locations where 1/10 of a mile of a county road, the asphalt was ripped off. And I actually got to go back on the ground later and drove some of those roads. And I mean, you drop down. It peeled off the asphalt as well as some of the base material. So when you drop down, I mean, we're not talking about, an inch. We're talking about 3 or 4 inches where there was a significant bump to
That's amazing.
It really is. And I think if Dr. Fujita had been around, I think there's a very good possibility that the Gerald, Texas storm may have well been the first F6 ever. Because of its slow movement, in my opinion, because it was just over one spot for so long. And the buildings that were destroyed, I remember one house, I stood on the foundation, and the vinyl flooring, which was glued to the cement foundation, was peeled off.
That is unbelievable.
That, along with the asphalt and the roads, it's just it's sort of unimaginable. And I know...
Because, that was where I was getting, because if you detach yourself from the emotion of it, the pure science has just got to be fascinating.
Oh, it is. And, you know, I didn't have to go to Greensburg. Some of those pictures that have been posted, especially several of the aerial photographs that were posted, I believe they were from the Red Cross, those photographs really tell the story. You don't have to go there to see it. When you look out there and for blocks and blocks and blocks, I mean, I think I've seen where this tornado was believed to be over 2 miles wide. It's like that's getting up there to the absolute nth degree in tornado climatology. And I want to stress what Gary Woodall was saying. I know during my tenure at the Birmingham National Weather Service office, we put a lot of emphasis on trying to get a good documentation on these storms, and that helps us to understand which events are straight-line winds and which events are tornadoes. You know, if we just sort of wildly classify every wind damage event as a tornado, you know, suddenly the state of Alabama's got 200 tornadoes a year. But the truth is we have like 10 times more wind events than we do tornado events. And so every state, whether it's Alabama, Texas, Ohio, Kansas, I mean, every state needs to know that climatology so that they have a good understanding of the weather that we're dealing with. So that's, it's really important. And I still regret, I regretted it when I was in the Weather Service, and I regret it now that I've retired from the Weather Service, that the Weather Service doesn't really put more resources and manpower into doing that, because once that information and that data is lost, it's lost forever. You're never going to get it again.
So absolutely no doubt as to the value of storm surveys like we were hearing about from Brian and in Kevin's piece as well. Good piece, Kevin. Thank you. One of the elements of forecasting that has always fascinated me is the difficulty not just of trying to figure out how the atmosphere is going to behave a certain way or whenever, but understanding some of the other factors that play a role in the weather we're going to experience. James, I suspect you would think that's a fair statement.
Very fair statement,
okay.
Yes.
And that gives rise to an idea for a new Weather Brains feature. Kevin has had his thinking cap on for this one, so Kev, tell us what's ahead.
Yeah, David, you were saying forecasting, you know, is a challenge for meteorologists based on where they are. Geography plays a big role and different other factors. And I know I have my little bugaboos here in Texas that I look for, and I think, oh, man, what's that going to do? And a couple of weeks ago, James was talking about the depression that sets in when the summertime thunderstorm season comes in. James, you were talking about that the other day.
Air mass thunderstorms, yeah.
So it would be fun to tour around the country and talk with meteorologists. And so I went to an old friend of mine out of the gate. Mike Stone has been a meteorologist in the Ohio Valley and parts of the Northeast for a long time. Good friend of mine. He's worked in Pittsburgh and Cleveland and Toledo. And I thought, wow, let's talk about some lake stuff. And so I wanted to get his forecast challenges. So I asked him about the ones in the area, and he said it is the lake or the lakes. So I asked if it was the lake in the summer or the lake in the winter.
It's just the lake, period. Because in the winter, it can really mess with your forecast of lake effect snow, because you can have one area, let's say downtown Cleveland, which has crystal clear skies, and then you can just go the matter of a couple of miles off towards the east, and you can be in a full-on whiteout lake effect snow squall. And the unfortunate thing is, even with all the advances in technology, there's really not a lot of good forecasting models to do lake effect snow.
And so what's the troublemaker? Is it the direction of the wind across the lake?
Oh, yeah. It's the direction of the wind is key, because even now living in Toledo, even like spring going into summer, if you have a good southerly wind that's strong enough to combat any lake breeze, you don't even really worry about it. But if the wind isn't going to be strong enough, you usually need a wind about 12 to 14 miles an hour to combat any lake breeze. So on a daily basis, even if it's going to be beautifully sunny, I have to think about, well, how strong are the winds going to be, which direction, and where we are in Toledo on the western shore of Lake Erie, if we get a good northeasterly wind or easterly wind, that's enough to shave 10 degrees off the air temperature or more. It's kind of two phases. The first phase is spring going into summer, because it takes so long for the lake to warm up. The lake can get as warm as 80 degrees in the summer. So it's not that big of a deal once you get into, like, late July and August. But this time of year, April, May, and June, the lake water is 50 degrees. So if you have a day where it's going to be 75 and you know you're going to have a due easterly wind right off the lake, you can have your far southwestern counties be, you know, mid to upper 70s, and you can have areas on the lakeshore barely breaking 60.
That's wild. Let me go back to the snow for a minute. Let's say we're fairly confident we're going to have a lake effect snow band.
Yes.
If the wind is out of, let's say, just east of north, let's say the wind is at 20 degrees,
mm-hmm.
coming from 20 degrees, and it shifts to 25 degrees, is that going to make a difference in the snowfall totals in a little band?
Yeah, because what happens is sometimes those snow bands are only a mile or two wide. The big thing is not only the wind direction, but the fetch of the lake.
And so when you say fetch, that means the amount of water that the air is flowing over as opposed to land?
Yeah, the distance of the lake that it's traveling over.
Because it picks up more moisture as it goes.
Oh, yeah, it picks up moisture. And the biggest problem is, as a forecaster, is where that band is going to set up and how long. Because some of those lake effect bands can produce 2-3 inches of snow an hour. And the big forecast conundrum is how long and where. That was always the biggest bust factor, would be snowfall totals, because you would have such a wide varying amount from county to county, city to city, and it was not inconceivable to put out a snowfall forecast of like 6 to 8 inches, nail it in a couple counties, and have one or two areas that had like 20.
So that was my good friend Mike Stone from WTOL in Toledo. He told me he's got one little area where he's heard from especially one viewer that if he sets up and says we're going to get a couple of inches or even several inches in a lake effect snowband, because this guy's area has an elevation rise as well, this guy knows to just automatically double to triple any snowfall forecast. And so that's some of the challenges that he has. And I'm taking suggestions for the name of the segment. I'd love some feedback if people like it, if they don't like it. But we're thinking about calling it Weather Makers and Troublemakers.
Yeah, that's a pretty good fit.
Sounds good to me.
Maybe
I like Conundrum in there somewhere.
Or maybe the Weather Hot Seat. I don't know.
The Weather Hot Seat, that's good. We'll take suggestions at question@weatherbrains.com. But seriously, if you want to keep doing that, we'll do it.
All right, fair enough. Move on to the Weather Roundtable, where all the Weather Brains, Weather Geeks, have something to bring to the table about weather. Mr. Spann, let's start with you. What's on your weather-oriented mind?
You know, one of the things that has bothered me over the years, and I guess as I get old and cranky, it bothers me increasingly, are these television promotions for Doppler weather radars. You know what I mean? You guys ever seen the, you know, mega Doppler Whoppler 10 million
our Doppler? Our Doppler is more powerful than theirs.
I really think it peaked. This was a year ago. There was a station in Indiana. I hope I get these call letters right. I'm pretty sure that it was WTWO in Terre Haute, Indiana. Did this big one-minute commercial criticizing another station because their radar was in the downtown area, and they named it the Doppler Dead Zone.
Oh, man.
And it basically said that downtown Terre Haute was in a Doppler Dead Zone, and your life is in danger because of that if you watch these guys.
Wow.
And it said their radar is out in this cornfield where our dead zone, nobody lives out there. And they put up a website and had a big one-minute promotion and everything. And I thought that's when the whole thing just reached its insanity. But, you know, Doppler radar is a wonderful tool, but it's not as good as these TV promotion people make it out to be. And one of the things that Brian Peters points out so well, Doppler radar does not detect tornadoes. And, you know, I actually saw a commercial in our market from a station talking about how their radar could see storms 200 miles away. Well, how high is that radar beam 200 miles away, Brian? 50,000
feet? Let's see. It's about, 18,000 feet or something like that?
You know, it's over 20,000 feet. And, you know, where's a tornado? It's on the ground. So the whole thing is just insane. So my call to action is for TV promotion departments to please consult the weather staff before you do these stupid commercials.
So this is really
wouldn't that be nice if they came in and talked to the weather staff before the promos.
But this is really just capitalizing, James, is it not, capitalizing on the public's lack of knowledge about radar technology? Is that not right?
I really think it is. And, you know, I've even seen Doppler radar promotions from TV stations that don't own a Doppler radar. You know, oh, they've got some software to display data from the National Weather Service. And, you know.
But they pass it off a little differently.
Oh, yeah. Our Doppler weather radar is the most powerful within 10,000 miles. And the truth is that they don't even own one that works. I mean, so, you know.
So consider the source.
That's just something about that. I saw something on some website or so. I was watching TV coverage or something, and I saw one of those commercials, and it just really hit me in a wrong way. But I there's no doubt the thing peaked about a year ago with that Doppler dead zone thing.
Well, speaking of radar, a little bit later in the show in WeatherBrains 101, the extinguished or distinguished, whichever, Professor Peters is going to talk about radar, and he has an interesting segment, so we'll get to that in a few more minutes. But Mr. Elliott, what's on your mind for the Weather Roundtable?
Well, I want to go into the far northwest corner of Canada. I'm traveling again. I love remote locations and weather extremes. So Gordon Toole and Wilfred Blizzard were the two men I'm going to talk about. They were the official meteorologist on duty in that small airport at Snag, Yukon Territory in the northwest part of Canada on the night of February 3rd, 1947. And the temperature dropped to 81 below zero, and that still stands as the lowest temperature ever recorded in the entire North American continent. And it was 81 below that day, a historic number because of that. And on that day, the alcohol in the minimum thermometer dropped below the tube into the bulb, up into the upper part of the bulb. So they had to scratch a mark on the thermometer bulb and send it to the laboratory to make the official judgment on what the low was. And it wound up to be minus 81.4 Fahrenheit. And that made headlines all over Canada. Weatherman Gordon Toole was a duty officer that watched the men thermometer that night, and he would hurry from the log barracks to the instrument shelter, and he could feel the cold air invading his parka, and he could hear dogs barking 3 miles away in the village of Snag because of sound waves being bent back to the ground and traveling so good. And he could also hear a tinkling sound, and that turned out to be his breath freezing and falling to the ground as a white powder.
Oh, man! I was getting nervous there for a minute, but anyway.
I know what you're talking about. They had 15 inches of snow on the ground, and a real strong inversion bent the sound waves back to the earth, and they had an airplane fly over 10,000 feet. And it could be heard more than 20 miles away from the small village. They could also hear ice cracking on the river, and it sounded like gunfire 1 mile away because the ice jams were cracking and freezing even deeper. And you did not dare breathe deeply while you were out there going to the instrument shelter because it could scald your lungs with freezing. And in 3 to 4 minutes, your cheeks, nose, and ears would be frozen. They had 6 dogs in the barracks on the airport, and their breath froze into a fog above the barracks, and it finally fell to the ground. And so that was the story of Snag Village, rather Snag Airport. Now, Snag Village, ironically, could have been a few degrees colder because it's a little bit lower in elevation on that night. No telling where I'll go next week.
That was interesting. This place, it certainly, I think, qualifies as being the capital of where it is truly colder than a well digger's derriere.
Yes.
All right. Brian Peters, what's up?
Well, I'm concerned about the warmth.
Oh, great. Global warming.
No. Not global warming. No. I actually have a hard time even saying those two words together.
He's hot under the collar.
Over the weekend, I do the blog video, our little map discussion videos over the weekend for James, and I thought it was interesting on the GFS this past Sunday, they had this huge low-pressure area, very deep low-pressure area coming out of the Western Caribbean, and I think James' discussion today, there's still identification, and plus we've already had Andrea. And so I'm just concerned about the warmth that we're seeing over the Gulf and over the South Atlantic and all these early storms where we're not even into the hurricane season yet. So just a concern. And, of course, NOAA is going to come out with their official forecast of the hurricane season, their prediction for the hurricane season. Dr. Gray's already predicted, I believe, 17 named storms, which is significantly higher than normal. I suspect NOAA's will be that way, and I understand a private weather firm has also said there'll be 13 or 14, so that's above average too. So it's going to be an interesting tropical season coming up. But as I think it was Kevin noted earlier, the tropics and the tropical systems may actually be the drought busters for the southeastern U.S., but we don't want a Katrina storm. What we want is a nice, slow-moving tropical depression with very little wind and just a lot of rain over a large area. So,
but
my concerns.
Yeah, but the placement is so critical. That just seems like such a long shot. You know, what if you have something move ashore in, you know, one point that's 100 miles east of where you want it? You don't get anything.
Well, and you know, you and I both know in the southeastern U.S., you can have a tropical storm just a couple hundred miles away, and you don't get anything in the way of weather out of that storm, even closer.
This is true. All right. Thank you, Professor Peters. And speaking of Professor Peters, we're going to go right back to him. This is one of the most valuable tools we hear about in forecasting, especially in severe weather detection. We all depend on weather radar. Even those radars that Mr. Spann was griping about, we depend on weather radar to know what's happening. But have you ever wondered how it actually works? All right. It's time for WeatherBrains 101 with the extinguished, or is it distinguished, Professor Peters.
WeatherBrains 101 with Professor Peters.
Radar is a tool that meteorologists have been using since the 1950s. A radar emits a pulse of energy that travels away from the radar. If that pulse strikes a target, such as raindrops or bugs or birds or maybe even David Black, a small amount of energy is returned or reflected, hence the term reflectivity used to describe the radar image. The ability to detect the shift in the phase of a radar pulse makes a radar special. It makes it a Doppler radar. The phase of the returning signal typically changes based upon the motion of the raindrops. This effect was named after the Austrian physicist Christian Doppler, who discovered it. You and I have most likely experienced the Doppler effect when a train goes by blowing its horn. The change in the sound is due to the movement of the source of the sound. Broadcast radars operate in the C-band around 4 to 8 gigahertz with a wavelength about 5 centimeters. National Weather Service radars operate in the S-band at 2 to 4 gigahertz with a wavelength of 10 to 11 centimeters. Both do a good job of detecting rain, but the S-band offers better characteristics for penetrating storms. Radars vary in transmission power, too. The WSR-88Ds, used by the National Weather Service, have an average transmitted power of about 450,000 watts. By comparison, a typical home microwave oven will generate about 1,000 watts of energy. But radars do more listening than anything. If you total the time of all pulses transmitted for 1 hour from a single radar, that radar is actually on for about 7 seconds each hour. The remaining 59 minutes and 53 seconds are spent listening for any return signals. That's WeatherBrains 101 for this edition. If you have questions about weather terms you hear, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Thank you, Professor Peters. Do you guys think he's distinguished or extinguished? I'm not real clear on that. Any thoughts?
I think that's a cool stat on the 7 minutes. I think that is fascinating.
That
I
is.
Appreciate that. Yeah.
Seconds. 7 seconds.
I say distinguished. 7 seconds.
Distinguished. We may have to do more radar segments, Professor Peters. That really was enlightening. So
thank you.
Thank you for the work. And there'll be a little something extra in your check. Just check with James Spann on that.
Right.
All right. Safety experts warn us about the dangers of trying to outrun a tornado in a car. We've sure heard about that. It was on this date back in 1999 when two people learned that lesson tragically. And residents in one Tennessee town will never forget what happened 12 years ago this week. We get more from Mr. Bill Murray with the latest edition of This Week in Weather History.
Let's look back at some interesting weather history for the week of May 15th through May 21st. On the morning of May 16, 1997, the morning low at Sioux City, Iowa, was 33 degrees, enough to set a record for the day. But as the temperature rose in the afternoon to a warm high of 91, it was enough to tie the record for the date, and so you had the unusual circumstance of recording a record low and a record high in the same day at the same location. Near Logan, Iowa, back on May 16, 1999, a woman and her mother decided to leave the daughter's mobile home during a tornado warning. As they fled in a car to a more substantial structure, the tornado actually began to overtake them. Seeing the tornado, they sought shelter in a ditch with 10 other people, and as they huddled there, one of the cars actually fell in on top of them, killing the daughter and critically injuring the mother. Now, age-old advice involves leaving your car to take shelter in a ditch or a depression as a last resort. Now we caution that if you have to do this, make sure that large objects like cars are north of your position so they'll blow away from you. And remember the best advice, don't get caught out like this in a tornado situation. And on May 17, 1944, Allied Supreme Commander Dwight D. Eisenhower made the decision to launch the invasion of France on June 5, 1944. Now, a lot of considerations went into this decision, including favorable tides and moonlight conditions, but really, early June was just the best time to attempt a channel crossing. Climatologically, conditions would be the best for the invasion. The weather on June 5th, though, would turn out to be horrible, and the weather forecast that led to postponing the actual invasion until the following day, June the 6th, would prove to be a masterpiece. A brief lull in the stormy weather allowed the invasion to commence, much to the surprise of the Germans, who thought that the weather was too inclement for a channel crossing. Did you know that Hawaii is the only state in the U.S. that has never recorded a temperature below zero? But on May 17, 1979, they recorded their coldest temperature ever with a reading of 12 degrees above zero at Mauna Kea Observatory, some 13,770 feet above sea level. Back on May 18, 1995, a tornado near Etheridge, Tennessee, not only destroyed six high-tension electric transmission lines that belonged to the TVA, the towers were never even found. And for many years in the 1920s, the residents of Codell, Kansas, stayed close to their storm cellars and storm caves on May 20th. Each year, it was a habit that was very understandable. It seemed that Mother Nature was out to get the small town. Codell had been struck by tornadoes on May 20th for three straight years in 1916, 1917, and 1918, each of the tornadoes occurring around 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock in the evening. Now, when May 20th, 1919 rolled around, no tornado occurred, and the town of Codell has never, ever been struck by a tornado since. And it was back on May 21st, 2001 that golfers participating in a tournament at the Majestic Golf Course in Heartland, Michigan, received an urgent message on their GPS units on the golf carts. The message coming from the clubhouse said that a tornado was bearing down on the course, and most of the golfers made it to safety in the clubhouse, although some had to take shelter out on the golf course. Only one golfer suffered a minor injury. David, that's this week in weather history.
Thank you very much, Bill Murray. Next time on Weather Brains, you're hundreds of miles out in the ocean. A hurricane is approaching. Winds are topping 90 miles an hour. 20-foot waves are roaring by all around you. And you have a job to do, monitoring the weather. But you're not worried because you're not human. Kevin Selly looks at how data buoys do their job and how we benefit from them. That's next time on Weather Brains. If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks at Weather Brains, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. And if you'd like to call us on the phone, we've got a toll-free telephone number, works anywhere in the country. 1-888-247-8627. 888-247-8627. For the Weather Brains crew, Kevin Selly, J.B. Elliott, Brian Peters, James Spann, I'm David Black, thanking you for listening. We do hope you can join us again for the next edition of Weather Brains. Weather Brains is copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Adios. That was a meaty, info-packed, radar-intensive show, guys.
Good that was job, a great tease.
A lot of meat.
I'm beamed over by it all.
I know what the segment was, and I was hooked in by the tease.
Oh, do I get a little extra money for that then?
The buoy tease. I knew it was buoys, and I thought, what's he talking about?
I thought it was gulls.
Well, you know, I was going to say
ooh.
Brian's, you know, tied up out there in the ocean, but I thought, no. You know, some people call him a buoy at times, but that's different.
Who is Laurie David?
Who's what?
Laurie David. Who is that?
She's very involved with Vice President Al Gore's global warming movement. She was involved in the production, of his movie.
I just sent a link to this. She has a new book called The Down-to-Earth Guide to Global Warming for Kids.
Ooh. Oh, nice.
Says, we want you to be able to enjoy snowy winters, to cool off between your sheets on summer nights, to see the leaves change colors. We want you to grow up to be activists.
You know what? We say that jokingly, but that they have figured this out, that they need to get the young minds early. It's like an indoctrination, and they are making, in my opinion, they're making a very, very direct effort to do so.
Very smart marketing.
You got that right.
Very smart marketing. I'll say two words, though. Climate Brains, as in climatebrains.com.
Very
yeah.
good.
Yeah. No, I don't want to get in the show on that. That's a rat hole, but that's a scary post we've got here on this thing.
Isn't it, though? Wow.
All right. Enjoy the show, guys.
All right. See you, boys.
Bye.
Good night. Bye-bye. Ah.